I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. If you live in Appalachia, you know that one of the most sensitive topics to talk about can be coal. Writer Silas Howe says he doesn't like what mountaintop removal mining does to communities and to the landscape.
When I'm talking about being against coal, I'm talking about being against these huge corporations that they don't think about the communities that they're harming. And for the most part, they don't think about their miners, their employees.
And we'll hear why some people say coal industry jobs are declining because of tougher environmental regulations by the federal EPA.
When we're telling power plants you're not going to be able to use coal for environmental reasons, it's pretty understandable that the market for coal is going to go down, and we've seen that.
We're going to talk through this today and hear from liberals and conservative points of view as we take on the complicated subject of the future of coal. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Folks in the coal fields of Appalachia are going through a tough economic transition. The coal industry isn't as reliable as it used to be. Change is difficult for many of us, especially for those of us whose families have been coal miners for so long. After all, it takes determination and commitment to be a coal miner in the first place. But this family tradition seems to be fading. Faced with competition from natural gas and increasing federal regulations, coal industry employment is facing a serious plunge. Layoffs and mine closings are becoming more and more common in regions throughout West Virginia and Kentucky. Today we're hearing stories about the future of coal. In our first story, reporter Catherine Moore went to find out what's next for those most heavily impacted by the coal industry's problems.
At Chief Logan State Park in West Virginia, dozens of coal miners and their families are mulling around a cavernous ballroom. State officials called this meeting to help them figure out what to do next after the coal mine they worked in closed. Del Maynard is one of these miners. His primary emotion right now is shock.
I've been laid off 3 times in the last year. I'm not kidding. And it's not because I don't try to find a job, because I found 3. Oh, it's awful. I'm telling you, this place will be a ghost town if they don't do something.
For others, like Steve Sigman, it's anger.
I think I'm more angry than anything because I don't think this has to happen. It's hurtful. Don't know really where to turn. I mean, I'm not an old man, but I'm not a young man either. And to start focusing on another career is it's a big adjustment in life.
Many are trying to bargain their way back to the way things used to be. If they could just get this one guy out of office, things would be great again.
Obama has absolutely stuck a dagger in the heart of coal.
And some are just sad.
Laid off coal miner's wife, baby on the way, and a 2.5-year-old.
Yeah, right here at Christmas and the holidays.
Why are you? Oh, I'm so sorry.
Kind of depressing.
It's an emotional thing, isn't it?
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
All over Appalachia, people are in different stages of mourning this thing that's put dinner on the table and shaped the culture for so long. Some are even starting to talk about a transition, about Appalachia, past coal.
Whoa, that's an awesome tractor.
Shane Lucas trudges through the cold mud at a small mountain farm outside of Whitesburg, Kentucky.
This barn right here?
Uh-huh.
It's pretty interesting.
Shane is pointing out a weathered barn on his property. It used to be a coal tipple, a structure where coal is loaded for transport. Coal's long decline in Appalachia really began back in the 1950s, when machines started replacing miners.
So they went up in there and tore the coal tipple down, come back and built this barn out of it. So this barn was actually a coal tipple back in the 40s.
That's super fascinating to me.
It's hard to think of a better symbol of economic transition than this building we're standing in. The ruins of one industry repurposed to house another, agriculture.
My wife wants me to tear it down, but I hate to tear it down. But it is going to fall down shortly.
Yeah. Well, maybe you could use the wood for building something.
Yeah, I'm going to. I was thinking about building me a building or a chicken house or something out of it just to keep it.
For almost 20 years, Shane was a surface miner, running a production drill at the vast Cumberland River coal complex near his home. He loved his job, but then, 2 years ago, his life took a dramatic turn when he was laid off by Arch Coal.
One day, they just shut the doors.
Drawed us into the room. We all started handing out the envelopes. And you open them up, and then there it is. Everybody was scared to death. Everybody's thinking, like, what are we going to do? Well, I mean, because there's nothing out here. Worried, you know, in debt. How they going to pay for everything? It was really a bad moment.
But Shane had a backup plan. He started Lucas Farm, where he grows all manner of fresh fruits and vegetables. By the time he lost his job, Shane was making some real money selling at his roadside stand. Not like in the mines, but just maybe enough.
Fooling with this, I'm never broke. I've always got a dollar in my pocket. I might not can pay bills, but I've always got a dollar in my pocket. I could survive. You know, if I get laid off, keep from having to leave this part, maybe I could grow. You know, my wife works, so maybe we can make it instead of having to move off.
The region is in a really critical moment of economic transition. For me, it's a really pregnant moment of opportunity.
That's Ivy Brashear, an Eastern Kentuckian who works for Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, a nonprofit that's helping to chart a course for economic transition in the region. Entrepreneurship, energy efficiency, forestry, and local foods. It's a tough transition.
Not that it's easy to make that transition. It's really not. It's long, it's hard, and it's expensive. But there really is no other option for us if we are to survive as a region and as a people than to search for alternatives and to do something else.
For former miners like Shane, there's still a lot to work out. Growing food is an old tradition in eastern Kentucky, but selling crops is actually pretty new. Last year, when his boss called and offered Shane back his surface mining job, he said yes. But this time, he's not banking on the coal mine reopening. He's got a plan. Over the next 5 years, he'll be turning more ground under, planting a big berry patch, and looking to source produce year-round.
Would my life be easier just go back to coal mine and forget this? Or do I still try to juggle both and shoot for something that may not never happen and still have to go back to the coal mine? That's what's hard right now.
So what do you think? Do you have an answer? Or?
Shoot for it. Go for it. See what I can do. Grow. Maybe somebody else around here might say, hey, you can do it. Hey, I can do it. That's what I'm after. I'd love for it to work out that way.
Like many people in Appalachia, Shane is just trying to find his footing. He's thinking about what to build out of the wood of an old coal tipple. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Catherine Moore.
This report was supported by High Plains News. This story and most of the stories you'll be hearing throughout this episode are part of a new collaborative series by the Allegheny Front, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and Inside Energy. Next, we're going to travel over to eastern Kentucky, where the Allegheny Front reporter Reed Frazier went to see what will happen to land once coal is gone.
Patrick Angel is a forester with the U.S. Office of Surface Mining. He's at the top of a ridge in eastern Kentucky looking over a sea of brown grass.
You can see it goes on and on and on for many, many acres.
This flattened hilltop is what's left over from mountaintop removal. This is the controversial form of surface mining where the top of a mountain is blown up and shoved into a valley to access a coal seam below. Many hills in eastern Kentucky now look exactly like this one.
Looking across this landscape, you know, if you didn't know where you were, you'd think that you were standing in, a prairie land in South Dakota or Wyoming, and because it's all grass.
The grasses growing on this ridge have roots so thick they choke out other plants, including trees. So the native forests of eastern Kentucky cannot grow back here.
Basically, Mother Nature is stuck in a place where she cannot return the forests on her own.
This situation is the result of a law that passed nearly 40 years ago to improve former mine lands. The Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act was passed in 1977 to protect coal country communities. Back then, it was fairly common for landslides to start at abandoned coal mines and just keep going into people's houses.
As the occupants were running out the front door. We wanted to stop that so bad.
And they did stop it. How? With bulldozers and grass seed.
The way we accomplished it was by telling mine operators to pack it in, you know, compact it, get it tight, and sculpture it like a golf course.
So this is what Angel and his agency did for 20 years or so. It did stop the landslides, but there was a problem that nagged Angel. The trees wouldn't grow back.
And then the scientists came to us.
These scientists were studying how to put forests back on former surface mines, and they'd figured out a way to do it. Angel takes me to a field that looks like it's been dug up by a giant rototiller. His partner, Mike French, of the nonprofit Green Forests Work, cuts into dirt and rock with a digging bar. Their group is planting trees here now.
It would take Mother Nature on her own to reforest these sites decades, if not centuries.
It costs about $1,000 an acre to reforest these sites, but doing nothing comes with its own costs, too. New forests can clean up one of coal's worst environmental legacies, polluted streams. Chris Barton is standing over one of them. Barton studies coal mining's impact on water quality at the University of Kentucky.
What you see, what we have here is, this was the original stream channel. And you can see the big, large boulders there.
The boulders he's pointing to came from a mountaintop removal site above the valley we're standing in. They were part of the rock, soil, and gravel covering over a coal seam and were pushed over the hillside to get at the coal beneath them.
On this particular one, there's about 200 feet of material on top of what was the original stream bed.
That material has turned the stream a bright reddish orange. That color is from iron that was once lodged inside the mountain.
But when you mine them, you know, you're taking a rock like the one we see over here and blasting that into a zillion pieces, and then suddenly it becomes at a size where it can dissolve.
Barton thinks if trees were to grow on top, that would prevent a lot of the runoff that's causing this pollution. And there are signs this can happen.
Okay, then. Well, we'll be in these two cells here for
Paul Rothman is with the Kentucky's Department of Natural Resources. On a vast surface mine in eastern Kentucky, he walks through a gate where a small but healthy forest is taking root.
And what you see is there are seven different species that I'll introduce you to out here. You got white ash, white oak, yellow poplar, or total
Rothman
poplar,
helped plant these trees palm, almost 20 years ago. Walnut. Today, windblown orchids, sweetbriars, and birches are sprouting from the forest floor.
The stereotype or the thought is that once these areas are mined and reclaimed, you can never grow forests back on them. And what we're trying to do is show people that's not quite accurate.
Up a tiny meandering mountain road in Letcher County, Kentucky, a coal company is finishing up a strip mining job. Huge machines move dirt and rock around a large open pit. Just down the hill from the mine are John and Loretta Henriksen. Loretta Henriksen grew up on this mountain. She's never liked strip mining.
But, you know, I'm supporting the miners and I'm supporting jobs, but, you know, I just don't like the way it looks. And I think I have a right to that opinion. You know, I think it's ugly, but I have to live with it.
She used to argue about it with her brother, who's a coal miner. But then came one conversation.
He said to me, he said, "You don't know what it's like." He said, "You got a husband that's got a good job and can feed you." And he said, "We don't. You know, if our job is over, what do we do?"
Her husband, John, was a school teacher. He had a secure job with benefits. Her brother didn't have that.
And he said, if you had to rely on a miner to make a living, you know, if your husband was a miner and he lost his job and you had no way to pay your bills or to eat, he said, I believe you'd change your mind on how you feel about strip mining. I mean, we used to argue, get in hot discussions about it. So then finally I realized when he said that, it just like pricked my heart. So I said, I'm not going to talk about being against strip mine ever again.
At some point, maybe soon, the mine at the top of the hill will go quiet. But even if no coal ever comes off that mountain again, it'll bear the mark of mining for years to come. Loretta Henriksen has come to accept it. And when asked, had she ever thought of moving, she says she would never want to leave the place she's from. In eastern Kentucky, I'm Reed Frazier for the Allegheny Front.
I'm from West by God, Virginia, and the high Kentucky hills.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear why writer Silas House takes issues with what he calls the double-edged sword of coal. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
I'm a scoundrel and a saint. I'm loved, reviled, misunderstood. I'm hope in a hopeless place. Hello, my name is Cole, and around here I'm the king. Some say I'm a savior, some say death is what I bring. Well, I've broke mine.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs, to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
The writer Silas House grew up in the hills of eastern Kentucky. In his novels, plays, and nonfiction writing, he's described life in coal country through rich, complex characters steeped in history and tradition. He's not only an observer, he's also an activist in the fight against mountaintop removal coal mining. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with him about coal and its legacy on the place where he grew up.
Well, I grew up in a coal mining family in a coal mining community. Most all the men that in my family worked in the mines in some capacity. My father didn't and I didn't, but most everybody else did. And, you know, you just grow up, it's a culture unto itself, and it's something that you're very proud to be a part of. We knew that we were supplying energy to the United States, to the world. We knew that it was hard work, and it took, you know, tough people to do it. But we were also really aware of the environmental impact it had on our community. When I was about 11, I guess, a huge strip mine moved in across the road from our house. And for the next 2 years, that sort of took over our lives. You know, we breathed the dust. We heard the blast. We just, it changed that community forever. And that had a real, I don't know, lasting impression on me. It made me aware of how double-edged that sword was, you know, of growing up, being really proud of being from that coal mining legacy. My grandfather lost his leg in the coal mines and recuperated 6 months and went right back in. He counted his colleagues in the mines as his brothers, you know, and so it's a really complex thing, a really love-hate relationship. Coal brought my family up out of deep poverty, but at the same time, my family and people in my community and my place have really paid the price.
So I wanted to ask you about your own entry into activism. When did you become an activist against mountaintop removal? And I wanted you to talk about why.
Even when I was a little boy, when the big strip mine first moved in, I was constantly wanting to challenge them. And, you know, I wanted my parents to complain more about it to the county and to the state, and I just saw how much damage it was doing to our road and to our water. It completely changed the landscape. When about this time, at a separate mine that abutted my father's family's graveyard, the coal company was mining so close to the graveyard that they pushed my great aunt's grave over the mountain and into the creek below it. And I remember how upset my father was about that. So I think the seeds were sown there for me, and I was always very conscious of all that happening. And it was something you couldn't talk about in a complex way, you know, because the economy came first. And so in 2005, Wendell Berry contacted me and 14 other Kentucky writers, by that time I had two novels out. And, you know, when Wendell Berry calls you and asks you to do something, you do it. And Wendell said, I want you to go on a tour with me of Eastern Kentucky, and we're going to look at mountaintop removal sites. And I knew all about strip mining. I knew about deep mining, and I felt like I knew the coal industry pretty well, but I really, even living amongst it, didn't understand mountaintop removal and how different that was and how devastating it was. The most profound thing, though, was that we had a town meeting where we invited anybody who wanted to come talk about their experiences with mountaintop removal, with coal mining. And people, just dozens and dozens of people came. And we were there 3 or 4 hours, sitting there, just hearing people tell their experiences. And almost every one of them would end their testimony by saying, nobody would listen to us. Please tell our story. And please get our story out there. And all of us sitting there felt like we had been handed this responsibility and that we had to do something.
What's the reaction been like in Eastern Kentucky to some of your writing and some of your activism?
Well, people tend to have really strong reactions one way or the other. You know, I mean, people write to me and thank me for speaking out and for being vocal about it. And then some people, you know, tell me that I'm a traitor to my own place, to my own people. That's a really hurtful thing, you know, to hear, because I care so deeply about the place and the people. I have a sticker on my back window that says I'm a friend of miners and mountains. And so, you know, every time I talk about coal and the devastating aspects of coal, I always want to talk about my deep respect for the coal miners, for the people who do the really hard work. When I'm talking about being against coal, I'm talking about being against these huge corporations that, you know, don't think about balance. They don't think about the communities that they're harming. And for the most part, they don't think about their miners, their employees. You know, it's all a numbers game. And so I always try to get at that complexity.
In your writings, you've called mountaintop removal not just an environmental issue, but a human issue as well. I was just wondering if you could explain what you mean by that.
As an Appalachian, you're told all of your life that you're worthless, that you are throwaway people, that you don't really matter. You see Appalachians on TV, and they're always portrayed as stupid, lazy, small-minded, illiterate. You know, I mean, it's always a negative portrayal. And you're told that your whole life, and no matter the pride that your family and your community instills in you, some little part of you believes that. You know, lots of Appalachians will say, I had to learn how to talk right. I've got a bad accent. I got rid of that. You know, there's this connotation that to be Appalachian, to have the markers of an Appalachian, is bad, and you have to get rid of that. That's why, obviously, I kept my accent, but I never could get rid of it and didn't want to. But I think something like mountaintop removal, the companies use that. They feed into that, and it's very cultural. They know that one of the things that we have always had to be proud of is coal mining. And so anybody who questions that in any way is attacked. You know, they're told they're a traitor, they're not a patriot, et cetera, et cetera. And all those things. Most of the people I know who've been active in the fight against mountaintop removal have had death threats. And, you know, I've had threatening letters sent to me about my children, et cetera, et cetera.
So your children were threatened, or somebody mentioned your children in a threatening letter?
Yes, I mean, it was written in a vague way, you know, a subtle way, but it was definitely there. One of those, you know, I know where you live, I see your kids playing out in the yard, was pretty much what it said. I mean.
And what was your reaction to that?
Well, my initial reaction was to not speak out again, you know, and then after a night of thinking about it, I thought, well, this is one reason I have to keep speaking out about it. I think that it made me realize, really, I was speaking out because of my children more than anything else, because I wanted them to have clean water. I wanted them to be able to, you know, be from a place they could be proud of, that they could bring people to, and it not be utter ruin. If anything, you know, it solidified my passion for the issue. It's never gone out of my mind. I've never stopped worrying about it. I was more protective of my children and reported it and all that. But, you know, you just you choose if you're going to use it for the negative or the positive in those instances. And I think it made me more forceful and it rallied a lot of people.
That's novelist, activist, Kentuckian, and dad, Silas House. This is The Future of Coal. I'm Reed Frazier.
You're Inside Appalachia. Today we're exploring coal and its widespread impact on the Appalachian economy, environment, and on those of us living in the coal fields, and also for those who are moving away. Now we turn our attention westward. More than two decades ago, Kentucky lost its place as the nation's number one coal-producing state. That honor falls now to Wyoming. Why did Wyoming become such a big coal producer? In a word, regulations. And now a series of new regulations are changing the industry even more. Lee Patterson of Inside Energy reports.
It's going to tell me to add paper.
Robert Henning is an historian at a small county museum in northeastern Wyoming. He's photocopying old newspaper clippings for me.
This is from the Gillette News Record, the local paper.
With headlines like Riches from the Ground and...
I believe a special section called the Powder River Energy Story. It's from June 1975.
The 1970s marked an important era for Wyoming coal, basically its birthday. It all started with the first ever federal law to tackle air pollution, the Clean Air Act of 1970, and the amendments that followed. In its wake, demand for Wyoming's low sulfur coal skyrocketed, and jobs did too. In 1970, Wyoming employed just 621 coal miners. A decade later, more than 6,000.
It's called Campbell County Coal, One Environmentalist.
As we look through the old news clippings, today, coal is still the number one source of American electricity. But Robert Henning is concerned.
Who knows what is in the future of the energy industry? So to have this document and record about what happened here in Gillette is very important.
That uncertainty about the future is a feeling shared in coal-producing states all across the country these days, especially with a new set of regulations called the Clean Power Plan. The Environmental Protection Agency's proposal aims to cut carbon emissions from existing power plants. And although the rule won't be finalized until this summer, coal country lawmakers are fighting back. Here's Wyoming Governor Matt Mead.
In the coming years, we don't need to let up. We need to double down. We must assure coal's continuity.
This fear, this fight, is strongly tied to the fact that many coal-fired power plants are already partially or fully shutting down. At least five have closed already this year, and it's not just because of the Clean Power Plan. Even before that, factors like new mercury regulations on power plant emissions have been mixing with market forces like cheaper natural gas and the rising cost of mining coal. It's all sowing anxiety in homes like this one.
Come on in, ladies. This is a house of many noises.
Hey, everyone. Coal miner Beverly Bauman and her husband, Rick Swanson, live in Rosette, a town in Wyoming's remote, coal-rich Powder River Basin. In the early 70s, Swanson helped build a mine in that basin called Black Thunder.
It was the biggest construction project I ever worked on. And I was just a little old tiny piece of it, you know.
It's now the largest coal mine in the United States. Beverly worked in the industry as well, and that's where she met Rick.
Fact is, when we finally got married, people go, "You did? I thought you guys were going to stay shacked up forever."
Over the years, the industry has been good for them and their large extended family. Steady work and fair pay. Nationally, coal production and employment is down, but Wyoming, so far, hasn't really suffered. Still, what do they see for the future of coal?
Rick and I came here, and we ended up in the sweet part of the of life. But the kids that I'm seeing come to work for the mines now, I tell them, are you really sure this is what you want to do? Because this job might not be here.
None of Beverly and Rick's children went into mining, but their nephew, Philip Karstens, did. As he plays a board game with his son, Philip explains that he moved to Wyoming from California 8 months ago for a coal mining job that he loves. But his son may not follow in his footsteps.
The way things are, probably won't be around that long.
These worries are real. And although the substantial regulatory threats to the industry are being challenged in court, if history is any judge, they are likely to eventually prevail in some form.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lee Patterson of Inside Energy.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues.
They curse me now for what I am, but not that long ago. They sang my praises everywhere. Hello, my name is Cole.
In the coalfields of Appalachia, there's a lot of speak about the supposed war on coal, basically pitting the coal industry against environmental groups. Conservatives blame the current administration for the sharp drop in coal jobs. Families are desperate to hang on to their incomes and worry about their communities if the future does not include coal. Other groups are pushing for cleaner technologies and a more diversified economy in place of these family traditions. In this next segment, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Executive Director Scott Finn tackles this often heated debate in his first episode of a new podcast called The Front Porch.
I'm Scott Finn, and on The Front Porch with me today are Lori Lynn, columnist for the Charleston Daily Mail, and Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Thanks for being part of this discussion.
Thank you.
So, hard times have come yet again to the coal fields of West Virginia. Massive layoffs, big cuts in production. Coal severance tax is down by about half in places like Boone and Mingo County. Rick, what do you say to that?
Well, I'm not one to downplay the hardships in southern West Virginia. I'm from southern West Virginia. My grandfather was a miner. My first big fight was supporting miners during the Pittston coal strike. I've tried to show up and stand up whenever there's a fight for retirees, for pension benefits, for promised health care.
You got coal bona fides, so I give you that.
And it is. There's no doubt. I mean, a huge part of our tax base, you know, comes from severance taxes, of which coal is a big part, and coal pays a lot of property taxes to local schools. I don't think there's any way to deny that these are hard times. In my view, and Lori may think differently, I think the problems with coal are kind of overdetermined. I think there's a glut on the global market. The prices have dropped by about a third over the last few years. The kinds of mining that we're doing are less employment intensive. There's cheaper coal out west. And again, when you base your whole economy on something you take out of the ground, every time you take something out, there's less in there. It doesn't replenish as you go. There's competition with cheap natural gas. So I see it as the problems. A lot of them are market driven. I don't deny that, you know, the regulatory thing could have a part. I mean, I don't deny at all the hardships in the coal field.
Well, I think when you look at the problems that coal is having, Rick is totally right. A lot of it is the market. But when you look at what's happening with coal in the market, I think you have to separate out what is kind of a true market issue versus what we're essentially doing to ourselves or the government is doing to us. A lot of the drop in demand is because there's great uncertainty on the part of power companies and power plants about whether they're going to be able to use coal in the future. That's what the court case right now is about. The regulations that the Obama EPA has proposed would make it very difficult for coal-fired power plants to even operate. So when we're telling power plants you're not going to be able to use coal for environmental reasons, it's pretty understandable that the market for coal is going to go down, and we've seen that. We've seen the severance tax go down, which is based on the sales price of coal, and the price of a ton of coal has dropped. But I think you have to separate out what's a true market. You know, has it dropped because there are really good alternatives? It's not obvious at all that that's what's happening.
Really? I mean, there's a boom in natural gas production.
Well, sure. Other fossil fuels as a replacement for coal. But yeah, this alternative energy economy that we keep hearing about with wind and biofuels.
Solar.
That really has not materialized. And if you even look at projections out into the future, the projections don't even look that great. So, you know, we're going to have to power the world and the U.S. somehow. And, you know, it's not clear at all that we're going to be able to do that without fossil fuels, including coal.
Lori, so is it fair, if I may summarize, is it fair for me to say you think that the investment of time and energy that our state and federal leaders are putting into this fight against these regulations is a good fight, a fight that should be made?
Sure. I'm not someone who really subscribes to the war on coal rhetoric that much. I don't think that it's particularly helpful to describe it as a war, but certainly pushing back on regulations that are really going to kill an industry that's an important industry, that is the most important industry in our state, I think that's a worthwhile thing for our state leaders to do. I certainly don't think that they shouldn't be doing it.
I've seen projections for the future of coal, and I think they do see it, you know, eventually reaching a plateau. I think coal is going to be a part of the economy, whether metallurgical or the fraction that's steam and metallurgical, for a good while to come. But if we could talk about jobs a little bit, coal employment peaked around in the late 1940s at over 125,000. It dropped by more than half by the end of that decade. By 20 years after the peak, it dropped by two-thirds. Coal jobs dropped by one-half during the 1980s. You know, this is not a new trend. I think it's really dishonest to think that if you get rid of the EPA and Obama magically, then we'll go back to having 125,000 people work in the mines.
I don't know if anyone would argue that. I guess part of this is just rooted in a feeling of these are good paying jobs for people that don't necessarily have to have a college degree.
Yeah.
And that, where does that exist anymore? And so I guess the question would be, okay, well, let's say these jobs are just gone. We just write them off. Then what?
Well, you know, if you want to go back 30 years, we've gone from Weirton Steel being the largest employer in the state to Walmart. I mean, it's part of a whole global economic trend we've seen with deindustrialization, mechanization. And again, anytime you have an economy based on extraction, there's fragility, there's boom and bust. And if you look almost worldwide, extractive economies everywhere have really serious problems, including political problems. So
it would be better if we didn't have one, right, based on extractive economies. I mean, would we be better off if we just didn't have coal, and maybe if we let it die or at least fade away, maybe we'll be better off. Maybe we'll be forced to become something else.
Would the state be better off? Would the world be better off? Would the country be better off? I mean, I think if you're talking about the world, I don't think you can say that the world would be better off without extractive fuel. That if you look at our
How about this counterfactual? Let me try this just for a second. What would West Virginia have been like if without coal? Let's say the coal existed in Wyoming, where a lot of it is now anyway, right? What would we be? Rick has thought about this a little.
Okay. My wife's from Vermont, you know, which is a mountainous rural state. And one thing that's really, you know, Vermont is not based on extraction. When you go there, you know, Vermont's largely owned by Vermonters. When I go there, I feel like I'm visiting the Shire and the Lord of the Rings, where the hobbits live, whereas West Virginia is kind of on the edges of the Dark Lord's kingdom, so it would make a real difference, I think. But that's counterfactual. I mean, here's my counterfactual. I wish we had 125,000 working miners, all of whom were members of the United Mine Workers of America, mining coal in a way that had no adverse impacts on the landscape or the people or the climate. That's my counterfactual, but the universe isn't particularly interested. But I think there are some real policy alternatives.
Let's say there is some common ground here in that neither one of us finds the terminology of a war on coal necessarily helpful. There might be some disagreement about strategy and how much time and energy we put into fighting EPA regulations or not. But then the question becomes, what's next, right? There's this whole project out there called What's Next West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I'll start with you, Lori. I mean, what do you think we should be focusing on next?
I think that's really the key question. Not necessarily all over the state. If you look at the northern part of the state, there's the shale boom, and there are other things going on with energy there. And, you know, you could debate the pros and cons of that, certainly. But if you look at the southern part of the state, I was reading Homer Hickman's book the other day, The Rocket Boys. One of the points that he makes in the very first chapter, I think, is he talks about McDowell County and how no one lived down there. Even Native Americans didn't live down there in the really rugged part of the state. The topography is just so, so difficult. There was nothing going on there, really, except, you know, trees and animals and nature. Then we went in and had the coal mines, and so people moved there. Now the coal has gone. You still have these communities that are left over, and they're very limited in what they can actually do down there. You have the ATV trails, which apparently there are a lot of Americans who like to go out and ride around on ATVs in this really rugged landscape. So that sounds like a possibility. I don't know how many people you're going to employ from that. You know, we talk about tourism a lot. That's certainly a possibility. But one question that I think it's fair to ask is, you know, should we have a whole bunch of people living in these communities where it's really hard to find jobs and, you know, businesses that actually will work, just given the difficulties of, you know, moving in and out of these mountains?
It's a long-term issue here. People have talked about it a lot. The mining industry brought people here and it goes away, but the people remain. They have homes and families, right, that make it hard to leave.
And that's a West Virginia thing, too. And that's a good West Virginia value, that we want to stay close to our families. We want to stay in state. We don't want to go off and do something else. But then in some cases, you have to ask, does it limit people?
What do you think, Rick?
Oh, I'm full of thoughts right now. I think it's the way we look at the story is really important. I think in America, we tend to think about things as an action movie where there's good guys on one side and bad guys on the other. And if you get rid of the bad guys, everything will be good. So, now, what I'm thinking is, like, I really think if the EPA would go away and there was not a black person to blame for all this, there would still be serious troubles for unemployment in the coal fields of West Virginia. And I think the same is also if coal mining would stop, there would also be real problems with tax base and jobs. It's more like a tragedy than an action movie. It's like, it really reminds me of a Greek tragedy, and we just need to kind of work our way out of it. And I think there are concrete policies that could do that.
Such as?
One, at the federal level, I'm going to give Congressman McKinley credit. He introduced legislation, bipartisan legislation last year, that would create some kind of relief for people who lose their jobs in mining, modeled on the Trade Adjustment Act, the people who lose their jobs due to trade agreements. And I think there are multiple examples of where the federal government has set up policies or to help out specific injury areas, whether we're going through like base closings or other kind of major transitions. I think the people and the region of Appalachia have contributed so much to this country by building its industrial might, our standard of living, helping it win its wars, that when we're in a time of this, I admire McKinley for coming out with that. I would challenge our federal politicians to put up or shut up.
Did that actually pass? Anything
it happened? Has not actually passed. And I would say, you know, all right, guys, you can cry all these crocodile tears about coal miners while you're not passing meaningful federal mine safety legislation and everything else, or you could actually do something. That's one thing that could be done at the federal level. There's also state stuff and also grassroots stuff.
Lori, what do you think? Is the government the solution here? Should they step in with more money and more training, and that will help all these unemployed miners to be able to find new things? That's not a very conservative point of view, usually.
No, and it's not like we haven't tried to help with, you know, the idea of retraining people is not really a new one. I think the problem is something that you alluded to earlier, Scott, which is that coal mining pays very, very well, and it doesn't require a lot of education. I think the average salary now is $72,000 a year. So it's hard to find, it's hard to train people who have lost their jobs in coal mining into a job that's going to pay that much money.
And those coal mining jobs, there's a cascading effect. One $72,000 a year job in Lincoln County or Logan County supports all these other people and businesses and family members. And when you substitute that with a $25,000 a year job,
sure,
right?
I mean, so you have people down there who are waiting for the coal to come back. And, you know, on the one hand, you could say that's futile, but it's also very understandable when you, in your very recent memory, either you or people you know were working in the mines and making quite good money. And, you know, in some of these families, coal mining goes back several generations. So it's you know, I don't think training is a bad idea. I don't think we shouldn't pursue it. But I think you just have to recognize that there are going to be limitations to how much you can do with that.
I'd agree with that. I mean, I think it's a part of the puzzle. We also need investments in education and infrastructure, you know, early childhood things. There are some interesting grassroots efforts that are going on right now. You alluded to one, What's Next West Virginia, where mm-hmm. I don't think people screaming at each other about coal is the most productive way to get through this. We really need to talk and listen to each other and try to figure out a way to get through this difficult period. There's Create West Virginia, where they're looking at entrepreneurial solutions and also recognizing that you want West Virginia to be the kind of place people actually want to live, where we don't totally trash everything. There's Our Children, Our Future, which is dealing with child poverty issues and has won multiple victories, bipartisan victories with a Democratic legislature and a Republican legislature. There's Try This, which is trying to get people to promote healthy lifestyles and local foods and physical activity. I mean, I think people are really trying to work through this. I think we should be as gentle as we can with each other while we do it.
That was Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee and Laurie Lynn, columnist for the Charleston Daily Mail, talking with Scott Finn. This story was part of a new weekly podcast by West Virginia Public Broadcasting called The Front Porch. For more from this series, check out wvpublic.org. Now, for the last bit of our show, we're turning our focus back to a childhood memory that stands out for Cynthia Ron. She recorded this story for StoryCorps. She grew up in rural Appalachia in the early 1960s. For kindergarten, Ron went to school in town, but her family lived out in the country. Her family wasn't rich, but her mother worked to make miracles happen with what little they did have.
I lived very far out in the country, so I went to kindergarten with a lot of kids from town that I didn't know. And I looked poor to everybody else, and certainly everybody else looked rich to me. And so I felt a little intimidated. And one day, the assignment was to bring in something that we could create a farm or a barnyard diorama. But when I got home, I took off my school clothes and ran outside to play. And then we came in and ate and got ready to go to bed. And I realized I had forgotten to do anything to prepare for this assignment. And here was Mama, you know, just got home from work, tired. And I said, oh, my gosh, I've got to get something that represents a farm. And we looked. We had nothing. I started to cry. And I said, I can't go to school tomorrow and not have anything. And Mama said, it's too late. I mean, this was, what, 1962 in rural Appalachia. I mean, there were no Walmarts. You couldn't just ride out and get something. So she said, you should have thought about this when you got home. The next morning, I went downstairs and Mama left before we got up and she would leave breakfast. And so I came down to the kitchen and sitting on the kitchen table was a barn that was made out of notebook paper. She had taken just plain notebook paper and folded it. She folded the walls. She folded the roof. She folded doors that opened so horses could go in and out. It was like magic. I looked at it. There was no staples in it. There was no tape. She had just sort of like origami or something. She had folded a barn. I had no idea where she learned to do that or how she knew how to do it. And when I came in to school, there were other kids that, you know, that had bags of store-bought plastic farm animals, But everybody was so amazed at my barn. And I just felt like queen of the day, and I knew that she cared.
There's no place I'd rather be. No restless spirit calling me. Sure is good to feel this way.
Had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front. Most of the stories you heard in this episode were from a series called The Future of Coal, a collaboration of the Allegheny Front, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and Inside Energy. We also had help from StoryCorps. Music in today's show was provided by Ben Townsend, Little Sparrow, Andy Agnew Jr., Kathy Mateo with Hello, My Name is Coal, as heard on Mountain Stage from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @WVJessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at WVPublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Spend a lifetime looking for what all along is at your door.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.